One day I'm going to call up and ask for Shiloh, see what he tells me. Then I'm going to wait for you to see it over here and say it in their dream.
You're on the court again. So some of you may be wondering why there are no sheets tonight for Mami Kamos. So we always start off with Shia. That's two halachas of this Gittara. This Gittara is why there are no sheets. I give you the Lumbda Shittara, so I give you the Prash Shittara. So the Lumbda Shittara says that I thought tonight, instead of speaking about one particular Shaila, I thought we'd take it up to talk about a whole bunch of many, many small Shailas related to something that's very much on with some people's minds. A lot of people are almost on the brink of going for Yeshiva Week. They're going away, a lot of traveling. So every year I get the same Shailas from Yeshiva Week about in terms of davening, in terms of Sosaderech, in terms of kashering stovetops, in terms of Erevin. So all the same Shailas. Like always, kids do that every year. I should just set up the following message. The day before Yom Kippur, the message should be, if you have to eat on Yom Kippur, this is how much you eat. And Erev Pesach, press one. And if you want to say a chametz one week before Pesach and you're going away, press two. And if you such as you're going to Shiva Week and you want to cash for a tray for microwave, press three. So we'll try to avoid all the shadows and we'll try to give a little bit of a smattering of everything. We're talking about Makobos in this. It's a little bit of Russian cloth and different things. So that's the Lumbish reason. The more practical reason why the Makobos is that the Talmud Amani, all the Makobos, already left Eretz Yisrael and he had trouble with his computer and he couldn't put together the Makobos. So if you get Zeb Gorim, it's a good reason why there are no Makobos. The bottom line is there are no Makobos for the Shia. We'll try to give everything over to Hashem. We'll try our best. So we'll try to, again, jump around a little bit and talk about some of the more common issues that come up in terms of traveling in general, particularly this time of the year. So one of the issues that always comes up in terms of traveling are the unique tefillos that are associated in Chazal with traveling. So one of the unique tefillos is tefillos Haderech, in the fourth parak of Maseches Brachos. That tells us a fascinating story about Eliyahu Navi appeared to one of the Amoraim and explained to him that gave him three good pieces of advice. He said to him, you should be careful not to get angry, because if you get angry, you're going to be chote. And he told him, you should be careful not to drink, because if you drink, you're going to be chote. And he told him, before you travel, you should say Tzvil Chadarach. So that's the source of the Gemara for Tzvil Chadarach. Then the Gemara gives us what the text of the Nusach, pretty much the Nusach of Tzvil Chadarach is all about. So it's a din in the Gemara, it's a din in the Shechonach, that a person is supposed to recite Tzvil Chadarach. It's not 100% clear when this tefillah is recited, particularly on modern-day traveling. Because even though the Gemara does give us certain guidelines, our traveling doesn't always correspond exactly to the guidelines of Chazal. And therefore, we many Tolkien look along the lines of a very vague kind of definition, namely it's a significant kind of a trip outside of the city. The person is constantly from one city to the next. So be driving for it takes me an hour and a half sometimes to get into yeshiva in the morning. But maybe I should start saying Tzvil Chadarach, we'll get a little bit quicker. But that doesn't warrant Tzvil Chadarach, because it's just I'm going from one town to the next town to the next town to the next town. That wouldn't warrant Tzvil Chadarach. However, if a person is going out of the town limits, this person is going far from away, so then he should recite Tzvil Chadarach. When reciting Tzvil Chadarach, so we show him have a big problem that Tzvil Chadarach doesn't meet the regular standards of Hilchos Brachos, because it doesn't begin with a Baruch. Normally, when you open up the Bracha, you start with Baruch Hashem, you start benching Baruch Hashem, you start Shmoneh Esrei, everything starts with Baruch Hashem. Tzvil Chadarach does not begin, it ends with Baruch Hashem, Shmoneh Esrei, it doesn't start that way. The question is, why is that so? So Tosfos in the Maseches Brachos writes that Tzvil Chadarach is not really a bracha. It's just a bakasha v'yam. It's just a request, a supplication for Kadosh Baruch Hu. But it's not governed by the regular rules of the brachas. And other Rishayim disagree. The Maharami Rittenberg's opinion was that Tzvil Chadarach is governed by the regular rules of brachas, and it really should begin with the baruch. The only reason why it doesn't begin with the baruch is because it's what's called the bracha smucha l'chaverta. Bracha smucha l'chaverta means when you recite a bracha following the previous bracha. Let's say, for example, Birchas HaMazon. So we start the first bracha with Baruch, but no, that doesn't begin with Baruch. Let's say Shmoneh Esrei. We start the first bracha with the word Baruch, but all the subsequent brachas do not begin with the word Baruch. Because once you have a whole series of brachas, one following another, it's all covered by the first Baruch. So Maharam Rutenberg writes that Tzvil Chadarach is always the bracha smucha l'chaverta. What in the world is it smucha to? So Maharam Rutenberg says that either you say it in the morning, when you're right after you say Birchas HaShachar, you're on your way out on your trip, you say Tzvil Chadarach, or you just ate a little bit of something and then you the bench, and then right after the bench, you go out on your trip. Well, you have a piece of cake, you have a little chlorine, and you go out on your trip. So the Rambam Rothenberg says that you can always maneuver those spinagel in such a way that's always a brachas b'chulachavrita. So in Shulchan Aruch, we try to follow the view of the Rambam, but the way we try to always make a derech a brachas b'chulachavrita. So if one can, so either every person wants to take a little bit of food, or a person has to go to the bathroom, or something like that, so that always enables you to make it a brachas b'chulachavrita. If all else fails, the guy's stuck on the road somewhere, and he's in the middle of driving, and he realizes he has no food, it's time to make a derech. You say it was dech anyway. You rely on Shitas HaKoyis. So the Ikra didn't rely on the view that it doesn't have to begin with Baruch. But L'chadchila, we try to be samech to another, to a previous bracha. There's another bracha that is associated with travel, and that's the bracha after one finishes traveling. That's the bracha of Brichas HaGomel. The Gemara says in the end of the brachas, that Abad Shichem Hodos, that the four people who experience a great salvation from the Kiddush Baruch Hu, and they have to thank Kiddush Baruch Hu for such. The Gemara says one of the people who has to praise the Kiddush Baruch Hu upon finishing some kind of a Yeshua, one is Yerda Hayam, somebody who traveled over the ocean, so he's required to recite Brichas HaGomel. So that's a big machlekes nefoskim today, how that plays out with manazeh. So there were really three different opinions in the Gedolei Nefoskim about what the halakha equivalent in the modern day world is of Yerda Hayam. So there were some poskim with the opinion that Yerda Hayam means exactly what it was in the olden days, namely if you traveled over an ocean. Even though in the olden days traveling the ocean was much more dangerous, the numbers of shipwrecks were significantly higher than numbers of plane crashes in the ocean. But nevertheless, that was the takana that if a person is a yerda hayam, and you finish and you come out of the yam, so you have to recite a bracha. So according to that view, if you fly over an ocean, you fly to Europe, fly to Israel, you would have to recite a derech. According to that view, if you flew to California, then you wouldn't have to recite a derech. And then the others who say no, that Yod Yom is Latavka. Yod Yom is a way of measuring sakana. Yod Yom was a barometer that Chazal used to measure a dangerous situation. How does it play out this man of Zab? We had a machlokes, the Gedolei Poskim, what the modern day equivalent of that barometer of danger would be. So Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was of the opinion that just the mere going on a plane is automatically called a makom sakana. Even though Rabbi Moshe concedes, he writes in his Truba that statistically many, many more people never get killed in car accidents than in plane crashes. But he says that Afal Bichain, he says a plane is still considered to be more of a makom sakana than a car, because it's not a question of statistics, but rather it's a question of potential. Namely, a car crash would be very, very dangerous, but a person can walk away from a car accident and not get killed. Whereas to walk away from a plane crash, not get killed, is much more difficult. And therefore, Moshe writes that flying in a plane by definition is called a makom sakana, and therefore one who survived a flight would be required to recite Brichas HaGomel, even if it was a domestic flight. Actually, from New York to Boston, you'd be required to recite Brichas HaGomel, because it has nothing to do with Yerda Hayam. Yerda Hayam is just a way of measuring a degree of sakan. So, go ahead. Some people, there is one opinion, maybe in Rishonim, that maybe doesn't have it as a full form of Brach and things of Sheva Malchus, so that may be some. The others may be nervous, but they're not quite sure when the modern day equivalent of saying Brichas HaGomel would be. That's where the custom started. And some say without Shem Malach. The post of Shulchan Aruch say we assume that it's a real bracha that should be said with Shem Malach. The Gemara says that any bracha that doesn't have Shem Malach is not really considered to be a proper bracha, so one really wouldn't be able to without Shem Malach. And so when it comes to Brichas HaGomel, again, so you have those who say that we just follow the regular criteria, the old stock, the theory of Yod Yom, whatever that means today. And the Gemara said, no, that's just a way of measuring danger, and the modern day equivalent would be any plane flight. And the Soloveitchik had the exact opposite conclusion of the Moshe. The Rav said that Yod Yom is a way to measure a danger, but Bizman HaZeh, planes are not dangerous. It doesn't matter whether you're flying to Boston, you're flying to Eretz Yisrael, you're flying around the world, that the statistics are so low of Chalil, anything going wrong, and therefore he didn't feel that it was a Machon Sakana. Therefore one should not recite Brichas HaGomel when landing. So there are three different practices that exist today. So there are some who follow Moshe's view, very, very few people follow that, but there's some that theory follow Moshe's view. I had a boss in Boston, I'm sure, when I was a Rabbi Paramus, that somehow he had asked somebody to come to follow Moshe's view, and he used to fly for business. Every Monday, Thursday, he was saying Brichas HaGomel. So that doesn't seem to be the popular view. The more popular views seem to be those who follow the Rav, who don't think they're going to go, and fly and Bizman HaZeh. And probably the most popular view is the middle ground, that they still recite Brichas HaGomel upon flying, but only when flying over oceans. People have been aware that if you take that middle position as the normal position, so then the Gemara says that Hochim Yidbaros also has to recite Brichas HaGomel. Anyone who travels over the desert has to recite Brichas HaGomel as well. So then maybe one could argue that if you fly to California, so you're flying over the desert, maybe we'd have to decide the Gomer. A guy who drives a lot, so we told Chayim Midbaras together, I got to decide the Gomer. I don't think that's what the minhag is. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what is the difference between the other Yom and the Chayim Midbaras. But getting back to that story, so again, so we have the Bracha of Yosef Derech and the Bracha of Yichta Gomer, that are two halachas of the Chutzpila that are related to traveling. Then you have the regular halachas of the Chutzpila that relate to traveling, but sometimes they complicate because of traveling. Right. So I'm wondering, I'm not sure that's called over Yod HaYamina. I mean, it's hugging the coast, but let's say a person in the olden days would take a boat ride along the coast. So I don't think that's called Yod HaYamina. Yod HaYam really means the person who runs passes over the Yam. I thought about that many times as I've watched out the window and thinking to myself, am I Yod HaYam now? I don't think so. Okay. I think the story was that the Gemara speaks about going a mil out of the city limits.
Yeah.
So technically speaking, that could be as much as a mil. That's part of the question saying before, then how much should we go with the formal criteria of nil, the exact number that Chazal gave us, and how much should we view it as more, is this a machzik baderech? It's not as that, we don't usually associate going to, I guess near a month, so you could argue, it could be there's a break of a mil. So we don't usually consider that to be a derech. So the problem is, whenever you take a bracha without Shem Malchus, going to most of the Shem, it's a meaningless bracha. The right that says that even though the Gemara says that Kol Bracha Shem Malchus is nothing, it's meaningless, the right that says that only applies to the certain brachas, that applies to the brachas of Hamotzi, Kiddush, things like that. But the brachas that appear in the end of a second bracha, speaking of the ninth second brachas, all those like strange brachas about Yom HaGadol, Mishan HaBriyah, all those kinds of brachas, and the Gemara was in that list, so the right that says would constitute a bracha even without Shem Malchus. Yeah, we usually don't do that. Yeah, we usually don't try to make these brachas without Shem Malchus. You don't gain all that much from making brachas without Shem Malchus. There is an interesting, you mentioned about flying, there's an interesting bracha that comes up with anyone in travel. That's the bracha of seeing a Sayyam. The person sees the Yam HaGadol, so the Mishnah says he's supposed to recite a bracha. The Machlok is what the bracha is exactly. He's supposed to recite the bracha She'asa. Well, if you see the Yam HaGadol, he's supposed to say She'asa Sinagadol. The Machlok is Mishanim, what exactly the Yam HaGadol is. Some Rishon say Yam HaGadol means the Mediterranean. Like it means in Tanakh, and Chodesh always refers to the Mediterranean. And others say, no, it refers to the Atlantic. That's the Yam HaGadol in the Losh of Bnei Adam. So there's a Shaila in the post in Shulchan Aruch. When you recite the Bracha She'asa Yam HaGadol, some say you recite it over the Atlantic, and some say you recite it over the Mediterranean. Whatever you think you recite it on, then the other ocean, the other sea, you would say, oh, say, nice and gracious. So the mistake of the demon in Shulchan Aruch, if you go to the Mediterranean to say Elsie Asagadol, if you go to the Atlantic to say Elsie Asagadol. So the post is in Ora, there's only one place in the world you can say it, the Chaladeus, that's if you're sitting in Gibraltar. If you happen to go for winter break, the Shiva break to Gibraltar, so then if you're standing on that point, you're flying over the Rock of Gibraltar, then you can recite the Bracha Asagadol, the Chaladeus. There's a famous story about Rav Steinman that several years ago, Rav Steinman, they slept him around Europe. They brought him from one of the places on his trip of Gibraltar. So they apparently they to Spain, so they it was a private plane. So they maneuvered it in such a way that they would be flying over the stop. He would be able to see the Atlantic Ocean and the Mediterranean. I guess they had a check with the flight control. They thought it would give this. So they tried to maneuver in such a way that he could recite the Bracha L'Chaladeus. So he hadn't asked them in advance. They just they figured that would be a nice, beautiful gift for Steinman. So the way the story was written up is that Rav Steinman, quick, look out the window, you can make us a nice, you could say us a gadol L'Chaladeus. So the way the story is reported is that he told them that, he said, I'm in the middle of a Tysus. He said, how can we shine it with the us a gadol? He said, I'm a Tysus. So that was perspective. That was just at the total aside. That was a very famous trip of Steinman. He went around the cities of Europe. He went around in Odessa, and he went to Berlin, he went to Gibraltar, all the up-and-coming cities, which had new clothes, new yeshivas. So he ran around Europe, they slept in the Shlomo. He was 95 years old at the time. They slept around Europe, they did a chiddush to all them. The reason why it was a famous trip, besides that story, was because I almost had a personal connection with him to that story. It happened to me, it's a total fluke, totally coincidental, that I happened to be in Berlin the same week that Rosh Hashanah was here. I was actually speaking for the yeshiva. Rosh Hashanah and the Shechta went to the shiur for the yeshiva in Berlin. Rosh Steinman had been invited also that same week. I don't think anyone knew he was invited. What wasn't, I guess, Rosh Steinman, the coordinating committee, with the Y coordinating committee, hadn't touched base that he was coordinating what. So all three of us were in Berlin at pretty much at the same time. So there was a big flyer and that was posted all over the yeshiva, the show, whatever it was in Berlin. There was a big poster that says that Chacham and Bola Ear. Believe it or not, it had a picture, not the picture of us, it had the following caption, Chacham and Bola Ear, two covers of Torah, of Aralim Steinman, and the Bershel Shechter, three covers. And then on the same fly with Bershel Steinman, it said a first and last, believe it or not, fly. Anyways, I didn't even take the fly off. Can you believe it? I didn't take the fly with me. Yeah, it was before, I don't think my phone had it. I had a camera on my old phone, so I don't even think I took a picture of it. But Adam Gamurim, Adas Gamura, yes, Rabbi Shechter, you remember, but the three of us were on the, you got a chuckle out of Rabbi Shechter. Okay. Anyway, getting back to the story. So, Luchas Tfila, regular Luchas Tfila, forget about the government goes down. Regular Luchas Tfila was very much impacted by traveling, and a lot of the impact of things that are not just the travel related, but in terms of Zaniat Tfila related. One of the big issues is davening early in the morning, especially this time of year. The Zmanim are very, very difficult for a person who's traveling early. As I'm sure many of you are familiar with from Luchas Tfila, just in your regular shuls, that Nate Tachamadi's days is sitting at 7:20 for the last couple of weeks. So that's the latest, almost the latest that it gets. And that's the open to a whole potential complications in terms of Luchas Tfila, particularly for those who are traveling. Very often, a person has an early flight and they want to daven before get on the plane. So that's a big issue, if a person permitted to daven, especially early time. So under normal circumstances, we wouldn't want to daven shachar before Neitz HaChama. The reason for that is that the Mishnah tells us in the Sefer Megillah that any mitzvah that's done in the daytime is supposed to be performed after sunrise. But the Mishnah says that's only the chetchiva. The Be'evid, you can perform mitzvahs even after dawn, which is significantly before sunrise, even after Elos HaShachar. Why do we wait until sunrise? Rashi explains the chetchiva we wait because it's very hard to tell whether it's dawn or not. So it's a cloudy day. It's very hard to tell whether it's actually beginning to get light. So therefore, Chazal wanted to make sure people wouldn't mess up if the mitzvah was too early. So they made a din with the Rabbanan that you have to wait until Neitz HaChama before you do things. So you shouldn't do the Megillah before Neitz, you shouldn't move, you shouldn't do a shofar, etc. until sunrise. So according to many poskim, the same is true when it comes to davening, that you shouldn't daven shacharis until sunrise. L'chadchina, but the evidence is stuck. You had to do it anyway, so the evidence would be okay. But l'chadchina, is supposed to wait until sunrise in order to daven Shemana Esrei. And there are some poskim who say, no, that it's not true. The davening is different. Davening is never included in this takana, right? Because the Zman HaMikdash, they used to bring the Korban Tomid in the Beis HaMikdash before Neitz. The Mishnah says that the Feirish, they brought it before Neitz. Because in the Beis HaMikdash, they weren't concerned with the Kohanim making mistakes, even though that happened one time they did make mistakes. The Mishnah says one time they goofed and they brought the Korban Tomid too early, but for the most of the time they were okay. So the Kohanim, they gave them a break and they let them bring the Korban Tomid even before Neitz. So add davening is connected to the Korban Tomid. So too, we are permitted to daven even the chetchila before Neitz. That was the view of some poskim. Then there are others who suggested that maybe this whole din doesn't apply to Zman HaZeh. Maybe even Zman HaZeh can do everything the chetchila after Elos because we have clocks. So the whole concern doesn't speak to us. That was the suggestion of the Aderes. Aderes was one of the Gedolei Olam in Europe, and he was the father of the Shkuk. So the Aderes had this chiddush now that everyone has clocks and wearing watches, so the whole din doesn't apply. And most poskim didn't accept that. So our approach to davening before Neitz is we try to avoid the chila. We're supposed to wait until sunrise in order to begin Shemana Esrei. However, if a person is a mashkin mederech, a person is in a rush, they have to get to work, they have to catch a plane, they have to run into the trip, whatever it is, so then the Shulchan Aruch lights, then for sure you can daven before Neitz. Even the chila, then you would be permitted to daven before Neitz. So in the normal circumstances, it would be better to wait. So here we have the shadow all the time. People ask me this question. This time of the year, throughout the year, the person's flying. And in theory, they can wait until Neitz to daven. The only thing is that davening after Neitz is going to mean davening on the plane, davening after Neitz is going to mean davening in the airport, davening here, then in here. So is it better just to daven before Neitz at home, the Nuchas HaNefesh, rather than get involved in all these funny kinds of places of davening? So I think the answer is that if a person is a mashkin mederech, the ma'aseh yilam, and the ikra din is if it's a shas al chach, when you have to go on a trip, if you have to go on a vacation, you got to go on your business trip. So the person has to leave the house early, so they are permitted to daven early. I would recommend that it's probably better to daven before Nates, even if you theoretically could daven after Nates. If daven after Nates is going to daven in a very, very bizarre place, you're daven on a plane and after things like that. If all else fails, it's impossible. Sometimes the person's flight is 5 o'clock in the morning, so you can't see the middle of the night. It weighs brayers, and you have to try to daven on the plane, in the airport, etc. If a person is flying, unless a person is flying to Israel, a person is flying in a regular airline, so it's probably not such a good idea to daven in Israel. You know, there's been a lot of issues that have come up over the years in terms of that. So I recommend people, they should shasukach. If you're afraid you're going to miss Mount Tvila, you daven without your towels in Israel. Then when you get to the hotel, you get wherever you can get to, then you put your towels and tefillin on. One just has to be very, very careful not to forget to put on tefillin. If one finds themselves davening earlier on a plane without towels and tefillin, or smach, where they're going to get to, they're going to put on tefillin. I would strongly recommend to put on an alarm or something to remind you, because I had a terrible story. Somebody told me a couple of years ago that they were almost broken. They told me that they were flying somebody out of this plane. They hit the whole Chagadja, and they had a whole Chagadja. They're going to get to the hotel where they're going to be. They're going to put the tefillin on. But they almost forgot. That's why they got to lay that. They almost forgot. They forgot to put on tefillin that day. So they were so upset. Never, their whole life, they never forget to put on tefillin because of that mishigas. So one should always be careful that if there's any chashash whatsoever, the ikur din, you can even put your tefillin on earlier, before days, sure, maybe even before mishiyakir, you know, because of the tefillin shalos. But if and when one is afraid, then one should always set alarms and be absolutely careful, never, ever, ever to forget to put one's tefillin on. Remember, once I had a... happened to have also lived in Germany, in a different city, it was in Munich. A couple of years ago, I was helping out an NCSY group in Munich on Tisha B'Av, and we were scheduled to daven mincha at 7 o'clock. And the first shkia that was in the mincha was called for, we don't have to show obviously in the morning on Tisha B'Av. I remember I finished speaking for the group, and we were done kinnis in the morning. I took them to the concentration camp. They had a whole day with them in Tisha B'Av from 3-4 o'clock, you know, I was exhausted. And I knew that I had to get up to daven, lay down for 2 hours, and wake up to daven mincha. And I was so nervous. I was in the room, in my own room, and all I was relying was a little 2-by-nothing alarm on my phone. And I realized that if I oversleep, I'm not going to put on tefillin that day. How many of mincha in the end of the world? But oversleep, putting on tefillin, I lay down in bed at 4 o'clock, I mamish couldn't fall asleep. So I said, the only thing that would calm me down is that I'm putting my tefillin on now. So I put on tefillin now in Tisha B'Av in the hotel room in Munich. And I remember sitting there and saying, what am I going to do now? I can't even say Shema. The Shavuot says that when you put on tefillin on Tisha B'Av, you don't say Shema because it's finished with Talmud Torah. So I can't say Shema, I can't say Tehillim, can't learn, can't do anything. So I remember sat there, putting my thumbs for 2 seconds, and took my tefillin off, and went to sleep. And then when I woke up at 7 o'clock, to go about mincha, I figured out, put on tefillin again, nothing to lose. A lot of tefillin that I've done. So I was probably the only person in all of Israel, definitely the only person in Munich, who wore tefillin twice on Tisha B'Av that day, because I was so nervous lest I should get to put on tefillin. So the bottom line is, if you travel, you should never put in tefillin. There was one other, the whole NCSY group was in a different place. There was one other firm guy in the hotel, and the Gemara says, I've when you ask somebody to do something, you have to assume that they're going to forget it. So I was just as nervous that he wasn't going to wake up, because neither of us had slept in the last 2 days. There is a question in the Rishonim about if a person says Krishna before Nate, so that is a Yotzei Krishna. So we pass the Shulchan Aruch is Yotzei L'Chadchila Shem L'Chadchila, but there's a lot of people in the Rishonim that maintain that you're not Yotzei Krishna before Nate. So some have a paid them in the Daven Masik and they say repeat the Krishna over again. Nothing to do with traveling, just stop. There's some people in the Daven Masik and they'll have the Daven, you'll say, oh, if you pass the Shema again. But yeah, it's a Chumah, it's not Nate. One of the areas that very much gets impacted by traveling, of course, is kashrus. Obviously, the standards of kashrus have to be kept no matter where a person is, but very often a person finds themselves in a non-kosher kind of establishment, a hotel, ski lodges, these kinds of places, and they want to know what exactly is the status of using trays for ovens, and stovetops, etc. So in terms of using non-kosher stovetops, believe it or not, it's probably a very, very insignificant problem. But the ikra din is that the stovetop is clean. It's cleaned off well. So the ikra din, one is allowed to actually take the kosher pot and put it directly onto the tray for a stovetop without doing anything. The reason for this is because ain't kli b'alem kli. One utensil cannot receive an absorption of taste from another utensil. So there is no food on the stovetop. All there is in the stovetop is something that that was touched by food or touched by a pot or something, that's if it's clean, so it's just a question of whatever is inside those walls going into my pot. The ikra din, nothing transfers taste. So the ikra din is, you don't have to kash, you take mamash your kosher pot, put it directly onto the tray stove top. The Moshe finds it right in the tshuva, but that's true when it comes to regular kashrus. When it comes to Pesach, we quote from Rishonim already, we say that we have a custom in Pesach not to rely on that kula. We assume that for Pesach, maybe the Rabbi is, maybe the rules will come a little bit more strict. That's where Moshe writes that the ikmik is in, if you move into a tray for house and move into a tray for apartment, you don't have to kash it. So you can just clean it and put your pot directly on it. But for Pesach, you have to kash it because you don't want to rely on that kula when it comes to Pesach. Even though Ramesha writes that, nobody does that today. Nobody in the world would have a dream of walking into a treif apartment. Okay, great. Clean it up. Everything is good. Let's start cooking. Everybody always caches their stuff up. How do you cache this stuff up? So you have to do what's called leaving cow. You have to make it that it gets pretty, pretty hot. So if you turn on the burner for a little while, cover the burner with a pot of water or something, if you turn it on so the heat gets spread out through the entire burner, you do that for a few minutes, so it's going to get very, very, very hot. And that's going to be sufficient method of kashering. So those who want to do that, when they come to the ceiling, when they come to the hotel, whoever it is, they should do that. It's a fairly simple way of kashering. You don't have to kashering with the burner. So you use one burner. So you take a pot of water or something, you fill it up, and turn it on, put it in the fire for a few minutes, and that's going to kasher the stove. So more important than the kashering is just make sure that it's clean. What about in terms of using an oven? You want to use a tray for ovens. It gets a little bit more complicated. If you happen to find yourself in a place that has a self-cleaning oven, if you're lucky, so that's wonderful. Then you just turn on the correct place up, turn on one cycle, and that's the holiday. But very often that's not possible. So what do you do? So there was a big machlokes that folks came about, can you kasher a regular oven just by turning it on to its highest for, say, an hour? So there were some folks who said, there are three magic words when it comes to kashering, kabola kachpoto. The way it goes in, that's how it comes out. So according to some poskim, you walk into a ski lodge and there's a trace oven there, you look inside, you clean off a little bit, and according to a little bit, make sure it's clean, turn it on to 550 for now, and showing its kosher, you can do whatever you want to do. The Rav Moshe did not accept that. Rav Moshe held that kibbolah kashrut doesn't work in middle circumstances, again, it's more of a technical kashering issue. And Rav Moshe said that the only way you can possibly use a trace oven is if the food is completely surrounded with something. And what would that mean practically? You have to take the food and totally wrap it up completely with the aluminum foil in order to make sure that there's no belief, that there's no transfer of space from the walls of the oven to the food. Again, there are different opinions about this. Those who want to be makers, like kashering their ovens in these places, have a right to do so. Those who are not, they would insist on wrapping up the food properly. Some people don't want to be bothered with kashering ovens. It's not worth it. You're there for 2 days. You're going to start kashering around in kashering ovens. As long as the food is totally wrapped well, that would be acceptable. Sometimes the person wants to just simply kasher a microwave. So a microwave is, according to many folks, is fairly simple to kasher. It has to be clean. And then we apply the rule of kabbalah tachbalto. That's what comes, how it went in, that's how it goes out. So you fill up a cup of water, turn on the microwave for a couple of minutes, it steams up and heats up a little bit of the microwave, and sure, that's an acceptable way to kasher a tray from microwave. For those who want to rely on that, have a right to do so. There are some posts can say that a microwave doesn't even have to be kashered altogether because the walls of the microwave never really get hot. So that's a technical question in terms of those kashers. But again, those who want to avail themselves of a trafe oven, either they can kasher the oven or at least wrap up the food. Those who want to avail themselves of a microwave can be the kasher. If they don't want to kasher, they want to wrap up the food very, very well. So definitely they can do that in any microwave as well. One of the issues that comes up often in terms of people who are away and is the issue of tefillas kelim. Very often people buy new stuff, and all of a sudden they come to the realization, "Oh, we forgot the toilet." And now they're in the middle of the boonies somewhere, there's no mikvah around, so what do you do? So there is a common misconception out there that you're allowed to use it one time. If you use it one time, then it's okay. So there's about as much validity in that as saying that if I go to McDonald's once, it's okay. I mean, you know, no such thing. You know, you require tefillas kelim, you have to tefillas kelim. Where that mistake may have come from is that Rav Moshe has a tube, but that if you have a kli that's a disposable type of kli, a very, very cheap, inexpensive, like a tin pan, or like an aluminum pan or something, so Rav Moshe held that you don't have to cover that. Not everyone even agreed to that, but that Rav Moshe was making. Once that, you have a right to follow. But if it's a real bona fide kli, you have a set of silverware, you can use it once, and you're still required to cover it. Sometimes it's just not practical, the assumption is only two rounds, so what do you do? So the Shulchan Aruch quotes today to the Chafilas Kalim that if there's no mitzvah around, so what you can do is you can give it as a gift to a non-Jew and then borrow it back from the non-Jew. Because technically speaking, the kli doesn't belong to the Jew, so it's not chayav and tefillah. That would be an eitzah. If there's a non-Jew around, but you assuming the non-Jew is not going to work with you or plea, so assuming that he's going to take your plea and then lend it back to you, then the ikra, then that would be accepted when you get back home, and you should tovel the plea. So that is a possible etza. Sometimes people like to tovel kalim in natural bodies of water. People go to these exotic places, in their lakes and rivers and all kind of places to tovel things in. So one has to be very, very careful when you're toveling in natural bodies of water to make sure that those bodies of water are actually kosher for tefillah. Not every natural body of water is automatically a kosher mikvah. So the ocean is a kosher mikvah, but not every lake is necessarily a kosher mikvah. Not every river is necessarily a kosher mikvah. It depends on a lot of complicated factors. It depends on where the source of the water is. It depends on, is it rainwater, is it spring water? It depends on, is the water moving, is the water not moving, how much it's moving, etc. How recognizable that moving? So a lot of factors that go into it. So you can't just assume because it's a big body of water, then it's okay. You have to, case by case, whether the body of water would be acceptable for the purposes of tefillah kalim. How much more so is this true in terms of tefillah for women? So a woman should never ever assume that, well, she's on vacation somewhere and there's some lake or something or other, so all of a sudden it's okay to be tefillah, and that could potentially be very, very problematic. So one has to be careful. Some lakes are perfectly acceptable, some bodies of water are perfectly acceptable, others are very, very problematic, and there are others that are somewhere in between that have different opinions about. One always has to, anytime when you want to avail yourself of any kind of natural body of water, both for tefillah kalim and also for tefillah for noshim, one has to be absolutely certain that mikvah meets the standards of what the mikvahs are. So a river was a big machlokes in the Gemara, and the Rishon about rivers. The issue about rivers is that rivers always move, obviously. So the din is that if you have rainwater that's moving, it's problematic to be a mikvah. If you have spring water that's moving, then it's kosher. So the question is the river more spring water than the rainwater? So it depends when. So sometimes of the year it's more rainwater, sometimes you have maybe more spring water. So the Gemara has different opinions about this. The Gemara tells us that Avod Shmuel, the father of Shmuel, he would let his daughters use the Euphrates River sometimes during the year and not other times. In the springtime, he wouldn't let his daughters use the Euphrates as a mikvah because it had so much melted snow that was coming into it. So melted snow is the status of rainwater. So he was choshish that it was rove megashamim. And rove is rainwater. It's moving. It's a very, very serious problem. In the fall, there's Tishrei. So the Gemara says the sun was in. It hadn't rained in a long time. It hadn't melted snow in a long time. So then, if the Shmuel was comfortable letting his daughters use the cross as a mikvah. So there's a long, long line in that Gemara that says that, basically quotes all the opinions about this, and it boils down to, is that if you don't know exactly what's doing in any given river, it's hard to determine this. Therefore, we have a practice that we don't use rivers for mikvahs. There are more quotes of practice that existed in some Ashkenazi communities in the Middle Ages, that they just didn't have the wherewithal to build mikvahs. They didn't have any money, they didn't have enough people to build a mikvah, so they would sometimes use the rivers as mikvahs. So there are more quotes from the Rishonim, like the Shasach HaGogel, those women who are using the rivers, you can't say that they're doing this wrong. They're relying on some opinions that maintain the rivers are still good, so you can't do any laws on them, but it's not the proper thing. So Chachila, one should never ever rely on the rivers. In case one's interested in just a little bit of a historical sociological note about some of the hot issues in the Middle Ages in Ashkenazi communities, so the Mordechai quotes a tshuva that from that was taken, that there was a running issue about kashrus of the rivers for tefillah nashim, and again, we tried to avoid it, and Rishon recommended to avoid it, but there were some people who were doing it. So the Mordechai quotes that apparently there were some people, and they would ask about shidduchim. We think that shidduchim resume is just started today. They had problems then also. So when people would ask about families for shidduchim, so they would ask this question. Maybe no one, it wasn't Olal Adaf to ask, does the woman use the mikvah on it? Which Jewish woman then didn't go to the mikvah? The question was the mother of this prospective shidduch, did she rely on those opinions that say you can use the river or not? That was the shadow that was asked. Kid you not, was asked in shidduchim. Did the mother use the river to the mikvah? Did she trek to the 10-hour shlup to the frozen lake to break the ice and what to be told in something that was kosher l'chaladeus? So the Mordechai quotes that they were showing me very, very upset about that question because they felt that was a tremendous mitzvah of a question. Because first of all, there were some sheep that were okay. The woman's relying on the Benatam. Rishon will hold up, the rivers are okay. The child is no good, who was conceived from such a tevila. And then second of all, it says, and what's the distance? Even if the mother was not a shenida, it doesn't impact halachically on the south of the child. The child's kosher anyway, they're called. What do you drain your cups? You make everybody feel bad. You're driving everybody crazy. So for not very significant purposes. You should stop asking that question. That was I guess if they had why connects back in the 1200s in Germany, that would have been one of the questions on the that we have to address. Anyway, back to the story. So the bottom line is that natural bodies of water we should try to avoid. It's interesting because the Gemara says in the Masechet Nedarim that the Euphrates River, that was the river that lived in Bavel, so they have a whole problem about the status of the Euphrates, and the Gemara calls that distinction that in the springtime it's a problem because it's overflowing, and in the fall time it's much less, so then it may potentially be okay. Years ago when the second Gulf War broke out, it was right after Purim. So it was actually the end of March. So I was listening to it on the news, and some of the commentators were doing a whole shit of Torah to explain why the United States invaded Dafka that time, why they started the war Dafka then. So we get a whole explanation that has to do with the level of the water of the Euphrates. At that time of the year, Dafka, these 2 weeks of the year, the Euphrates River was high, and it was yet to cross, and the whole chagadja about the Euphrates River. So I remember listening to myself and thinking that a lot of things have changed in the last 2,000 years, but the Euphrates is doing exactly what it did 2,000 years ago. It's filled up in March, and it's empty in September. Nothing has changed since the days of Isagracius. So I could have given that whole shtickle Torah for the Pentagon just to run right out of Rodham Masechet. Anyway, getting back to that story. So another area of Halacha, of course, is really impacted by travel, is Shabbos. So it's a good time as ever to focus on the fact that people should be careful to travel on Friday. There are dinim about how close to Shabbos one is allowed to travel, how far you're allowed to travel. The bottom line is it's 99% common sense that if you think that you're not going to make it in terms of Shabbos, then don't start. And if you have a chance, if you're not sure, then don't start either. The person should, the chacham and the rosho, not get stuck in these kinds of situations. So a person is traveling and they find themselves never on the road and it's also about to be Shabbos, so short of the Kuch Nefesh, one is not permitted to drive the car after Shtia. Once the sun sets, it's overdone, finished, unless there's a chashash of the Kuch Nefesh. Even if it's going to mean a miserable Shabbos tucked away in some on Hal Johnson somewhere in the middle of nowhere with nothing to eat and spending Shabbos with a bunch of truckers on the way, whatever, unless it's the Kuch Nefesh, under no circumstances is the person permitted to drive the car at all on Shabbos. There are two situations where Mamash permitted somebody stuck in the road to continue to drive after Shtia, because that's what they were both concerned with the Kuch Nefesh. One was there was a young mother who had a couple of little babies with her, and she was going to meet a husband somewhere, and she got stuck in the New Jersey Turnpike somewhere down exits 3 and 4 in the middle of Mamash of nowhere, and the only way for her to pull over was a trucking rest stop and spend the entire Shabbos there. I think that was Mamash's concern. 22-year-old girl with the two babies with truckers on the side of the turnpike, I didn't think that was a safe situation. But I told her she can continue to mamish drive until she feels that she gets the place that was safe. The other situation was somebody called me, they were stuck on the old Gaffles Bridge. Not the reason, the old Gaffles Bridge, and those who remember the old Gaffles Bridge, that one just rebuilt 6 months ago. The old Gaffles Bridge, as the Tosfos says, Sherin Derech, the Tosfos Midot Shmol, there is no shoulder, there is no nothing, and if you would stop your car and try to, if you'd sit there, so you would for sure get hit. And if you would try to walk, there is ain mokum. There's no place to walk. And chalil, a guy can get killed. So I told the fellow that he can continue driving and gets off the bridge. Until he gets the first place of safety to stop the car, then it'll be a miserable Shabbos somewhere, whatever it'll be. But he said, you cannot drive after Shkia, even for a second, unless it's mamash chashash of Pikuch Nefesh. Of course, that's chokham in the Barosho in terms of planning those kinds of things. Sometimes the person ends up there traveling, they're not the one who's driving, they end up on a bus, they end up on a train, they end up on a plane. So that's the difference. That's the yoga. The person shouldn't have been on the plane, but the mice is on the plane. So now when he gets off the plane, so that becomes a very complicated story in terms of the chum and other things, in terms of where he can I go. I'm beyond the scope right now to talk about all that. But Chazal did give us an important kula that if the person gets stuck on the road and Shabbos begins, so Chazal permitted certain servants of Rabbanan because they're afraid that a person is going to be so nervous about his money. And Chazal said that if you tell a person to drop all his money, drop all his valuables, and not carry them at all, so then that's not going to go over too well. And he's going to end up mamish carrying the deraisa. So therefore Chazal made a compromise. They said, we're going to lift the servants of Rabbanan for the person who's mishach shechlo bederech. The person got stuck in the way, he's got all his money with him, so then with the Rabbanan, you'll let him violate the Rabbanan. So the message you can carry, pachas the dalal amas. You can stop and start less than 3 hours, and you don't bring it into a shushiyach itself. So you're just walking in the street and stopping and starting, that would be okay. I remember years ago, I was in a place where there was no Erev, the whole day there was no Erev, and I saw a fellow on Friday night, it was late on Friday night, it was an hour after Shkia. I saw a fellow, it looked like a very friendly-looking guy, he was a little beard, a long coat, and I see him carrying a suitcase. It's Friday night. There's no Erev here. Everyone knows there's no Erev there. And then I noticed that he's stopping, and he's starting. The mamash got stuck somewhere with a suitcase, and he knew the halacha. You're allowed to be molus, tachos, be daladamas. I was a little nervous about him because he was trying to cross a major, major street. And I assume we made it, but it was interesting because I was nervous. I remember years ago we had a problem in our shul where one Friday, a big backup to the Lincoln Tunnel, half my shul guy got stuck in the city. So they ended up in a bus. The guy off the bus about 2 hours after Shki or something, he arranged for a non-Jew to meet them by the bus to take all the stuff to Emilia Akron, to take all the stuff off the bus because the bus stopped, it was out of the air. Now it's in the area, that area on my state street. It used to be out of the area. So we had a guy who was waiting there by the bus. And the bus driver wouldn't let the guy onto the bus because there was a security violation. I'm not afraid of exactly. But they insisted that the Jews get off the bus with all the stuff because the guys didn't know what to do. So one of them remembered this halacha. You're allowed to do things till Yachid. You're allowed to do things in abnormal fashion. So 10 guys marched off the bus. One guy had a computer under his arm, and a guy had his wallet on his head, and a guy had his cell phone in his foot, and everything was done to Lechayad until the guy was left with him. But again, these are after the fact. This is not supposed to happen. The trips are supposed to be nice, calm, and relaxing. They're supposed to end up in the right place at the right time. Maybe years ago, way before the days of Waze and way before the days of GPS, a long time ago. So we were going to Detroit for Shabbos. We were driving, we had a couple of day trips, and we were in Niagara Falls. We were driving from Niagara Falls to Detroit. It was a 4 hour drive, and it was July. Shabbos was very, very late in Detroit. It was 3 o'clock, we left Niagara Falls at 3 o'clock. It was a 4 hour trip. We had a good buffer, 3 hours, or 2-3 hours of a buffer. And we didn't do too much. We got on the highway going in the wrong direction. It took us 45 minutes because we realized we were going the wrong way. So that just meant, of course, an hour and a half. So I remember the feeling of, and again, cell phones, nothing, I'm Scottish. I remember pulling into Detroit at 8:45 at night, Friday night. That was the good news that Shkia wasn't until 9:30, because Shkia is the bottom of very, very often Detroit. I mean, it's supposed to be on the other side of the thanks to Henry Ford, they put them in the wrong time zone. So it's Shkia, it was like 9:30. So I remember driving the car, looking at my watch, it's 8:45 on Friday night. In the car, driving in, starting without the set in about another 45 minutes. So those are things that are not supposed to happen. So once you try to plan accordingly, okay, I wish you have safe trips and enjoy everything. So next week, I went there for the Shabbat and Simcha next week. And 2 weeks from now is Yeshiva break. So usually we don't have, cancel that, we'll discuss it, or we'll talk about it. And when we'll talk about it, we'll figure out, we'll get the word out, what we'll have it now. But next week, the next issue.